Hello, and welcome to EPR with your favorite environmental nerds, Nick and Laura. On today's episode, we give our shout-outs. Nick and I discuss leadership and employee retention. We talk to Desiree Martinez, the president at Cogstone Resource Management, about the preservation of Native American sacred and cultural sites, developing and maintaining good tribal relationships, and having fun in the field. And finally, bear with me now, on this day in science, 1902, a patent is obtained for barbituric.
Sorry,
missed that.
Yeah, keep reading. You'll find out.
In 1864, Adolf Van Bayer, a 29-year-old assistant of Frederick August Kekulé, the discoverer of the molecular structure of benzene, synthesized barbituric acid, the first barbiturate.
Hey.
In 1903, the German chemist Emil Fischer and his collaborator Joseph von Mehring modified a class of drugs originally synthesized in 1864 in a way that made them effective as sedatives and hypnotics. Whoa. Fischer and Mehring realized that their new drug, diethyl barbituric acid, or barbitol, was a sedative.
How about that?
It improved vastly upon the conjuries. Is this written in Old English?
It is, yeah, pretty much.
Improved upon the conjuries of previous sedatives by not tasting unpleasant, by having few side effects, and by acting at therapeutic levels far beneath the toxic dose. Do we have the copyrights for this? Is this like directly taken from somewhere?
Oh yeah,
unlike potassium bromide, which tasted awful and had a therapeutic level close to the toxic dose.
Which is crazy. That's crazy to me that they were like, yeah, this almost kills you, but not quite. So it's good.
Dialol, yeah. That's a fun word. Barbituric acid is a colorless crystalline organic compound used in medicine as a soporific.
I have no idea. But this is this day in science is the website, right. By the way.
I should preface this with get your dictionary out.
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, please be sure to ignore what I just said. Please be sure to subscribe, rate, and review. Hit that music.
Yeah, that was the hardest one. It came directly from, and I didn't change it at all. I was like, this is too funny.
Well, maybe we this can day decide where it came from.
This day in science is the name of the website.
Okay, so just in case there's copyrights things happening here, let's give our this day in science. Wait, thank you much.
No, it's I'm so sorry. It's today in science history.
Oh, okay.
Todayinsci.com. That's where it came from.
Well, thank you. Today in science history for this intriguing and difficult to say.
Yeah, difficult assignment. Yeah. It's so weird. You know, I don't know if you noticed this, but it seems to be that yours are harder than mine. I don't know. I don't know what that's about. It's so strange. Our shout outs for today go to the team behind the New York City Department of Design and Construction East Side Coastal Resiliency EIS. They are the winners of the 2021 NEPA Planning Integration Award for their streamlined documentation approach to satisfying federal, state, and city NEPA regulations, which is crazy. Yeah, New York City's got a lot of what really wild environmental regulations beyond the regular, and that's really cool. So congrats to them for that. Really happy that they were able to get that award. So if you'd like to share your promotions, new jobs, or professional and project awards with us, check out the EPR website. And if you'd like to sponsor a future episode, head on over to www.environmentalprofessionalsradio.com and check out our sponsor form for details. Let's get to our segment. Now, I did want to talk to you about something today. I wanted to talk to you about, you know, leadership in regard to employee retention. So it's something that I actually heard on another podcast, on a sports podcast of all things. But they had a psychologist on, and John Amici, and he's a former NBA player. But he's also like a really big advocate for just mental health in general. But on this particular episode, he was actually talking about employee retention and empathy. And, you know, sometimes I think a lot of times people, you know, I've seen this happen in companies and organizations where they ask, you know, why are people leaving? Why are they leaving after 18 months? Why aren't they, you know, joining our plan to get free money from us? Why aren't they doing these things? Yeah. And I think, you know, I think that's a really good question to ask, but if you're asking it, then you've already, you haven't done the work, right? if you don't know the answer. So, you know, I think a lot of that, but at least what I've seen, I don't know, I'd love to hear your perspective on this too, but what I've seen is, you know, it's, you've got to make connection points. It's just like, you know, when you have clients that you want to get to know, when you have anything that you're trying to market or learn, you have to learn who those people are. You have to get to know them. You need to build a relationship. That goes for your employees as well. If they don't know who you are, why would they stay? If they don't have any connection to you, why would they stay? You know?
Yeah.
And it can be a pretty powerful thing if you just talk to people on a consistent basis and just ask how they're doing, not just about work. Ask how they're doing in general. You know, what's going on? What are we doing? What do we need to do for you?
Yeah. Well, the thing that you're referring to is caring.
Yeah.
The problem is that a lot of leaders and business owners, when you get down to it, they don't care.
Right.
You know, I actually teach a lot of workshops around this type of topic. And there's this point where you hire people and then you turn on them. So one of my workshops is extreme accountability.
Right.
And part of that for business owners and senior leaders is that you are accountable for the happiness and welfare of your employees, like it or not.
Yeah. And, yeah, exactly.
But lots of managers, especially, haven't been taught that. That's not what's expected of them in their leadership positions in an organization. Mm-hmm. And you can't make people care. You have to hire people that care. So you as a CEO or your senior leadership team need to be hiring people who do care, and then nurturing that value and putting it into the way that you work so that it is genuine when people are asking those questions. And you can have, so having environmental companies where you have lots of engineers, they're not necessarily people persons, right? So, but doesn't mean they don't care. It just means they might show it in a different way.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's where systems and processes can help to support when you have a lack of people who, you know, aren't really those like I'm not a hand holder, a sugar coater.
What?
I got to step back and then, you know, cut some people some slack. But I do a lot to set up reminders for myself. I have a reminder on my phone every Thursday that says communicate with your team, because I will get so head down in the work, I will forget to tell them. So every week, regardless what is going on in my world, I say, hey, hope you're having a great week. It doesn't happen by accident. People have to put those strategies into place.
Yeah, 100%.
I get worked up over this stuff.
No, I know. I knew you would, by the way. I knew you would. That's why I brought it up. It's
But it's great. Yeah. You know, you mentioned this before. Like, people don't quit businesses. They quit bosses.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's exactly right. And it's not a, one size fits all. Everybody's a little different. And you have to, you know, and I guess there's some incentive for, you know, there's some people that you have that are just great, great employees, right? And you want to keep them. And there's an incentive there. Right. If you don't have great employees, you don't want to keep them. You don't want to retain them. That's another problem that you have.
Right.
And you need to look at your hiring process, you know?
Exactly. So that brings you to a different scenario. So one, you need to have caring leaders and managers. Right. And that has to be an expectation that whoever is at the very tippy top is setting. Right. Mm-hmm. And then you also have to have strategies around your hiring practices that are not just setting the stage to hire people, but also to retain them. Because honestly, what's the point of hiring people if they're just going to leave, or you're going to push them away, or you're going to turn on them? Because that's what frustrates me the most. It's like, you hired this person, you believed in them that they could do the job, or you wouldn't have hired them.
Right.
So at what point did something change that they either couldn't do the job? They did, you know, did you lie to them in the hiring practice and tell them how great your culture is and that you do care?
Right.
And then you didn't show that to them. So now they're ready to leave.
Yeah. Culture is big. It's a huge thing for people. And like, I think that's been a shift, you know, more recently, like, you know, people are looking for empathetic leaders, which I know is not the standard model. At least it wasn't, you know, 10, 15 years ago. So it's really important. Culture is a very big deal. And I think it's only more so important and more important for younger staff as we keep moving forward. It's a really good point.
I think a key thing that you're also mentioning is getting to the why. So if you have people leaving, you can't just keep saying, what I'll hear from business managers is, we can't keep people. People keep leaving. Well, okay, sit down, strategize around, like, figure out what the problem is. Is it your culture? Is it that your managers aren't caring? What are they writing about you on Glassdoor? There are clues out there, you know?
Yeah.
Survey your existing employees and find, you know, like, dig into it. I think honestly, a lot of senior leadership teams are, they have their rose-colored glasses on and they think they're doing everything right. And they're really avoiding the hard conversations with themselves to say, again, extreme accountability. This is on us. What do we do about it?
What do we do about it? And yeah, because if it's a pattern, what's the phrase? If you go throughout your day and you meet a jerk, right? You meet one jerk, that's the jerk, right? If you go throughout the day and everyone's a jerk, you're the jerk, right?
Right.
And so that's the phrase here. It's like, that's the problem. If you have a pattern and you're the only connection point to the pattern, then it's you.
Right.
And it's hard. I think it's hard for people to see that because they don't want to think they're doing things wrong.
Yeah. And there's really so many difficult things to look at too. Like, is it one division? Is it one, you know, that's going to be a pointer to the whoever's managing those people. Is it a type of role or is it just across the board, you know? And then again, once you've identified what those problems are, you've got to strategize long-term what those fixes are because they're probably not easy fixes.
Right. And it's not overnight. It's like you said, it's going to take some time and some energy and maybe some money too, which people don't like to hear. But you know, if you want to keep people, you gotta spend some money sometimes.
Yeah. You could be losing people because you're the cheapskates and people are getting their foot in the door with you and they're taking, you know, their experience somewhere else. You don't want to be that person.
No.
That person as a company, you know.
Because then you're wasting time. You're wasting your time training people that won't. Because it's so much nicer to have someone who is trained can then train someone else. That's much easier. That means you can do your job better. So yeah, you want to keep people. But yeah, that's a good one. That's a good place to end. Let's go ahead and head to our interview.
Sounds great. Toby's ready.
Yes, he is. Hello and welcome back to EPR. Today, we are excited to be joined by Desiree Martinez, who is a Tongva tribal archaeologist and the president at Cogstone Resources Management Incorporated, which specializes in paleontology, archaeology, and history, serving both public and private sector clients. Desiree, thank you for being here.
Thank you for the invitation.
So what do you do at Cogstone?
So basically, as president, I am the leader of the helm of the ship. So Cogstone is actually celebrating our 20th anniversary this month.
Oh, nice.
And I have been in the position of president for the last year because the previous owner of the company passed away unexpectedly in 2019. And so the company was sold to employees that had been chosen by her previously. And we are now at the end of the transition from her helm to what we currently have being run by a board of directors. And so I help not only to run the company and make sure we have financial health, but also to help train our employees in the ways that we want to run the company in terms of being ethically responsible and making sure that we do good research.
Yeah.
Awesome. So you pretty much dedicated your life to the preservation of Native American sacred and cultural sites. Has this always been your passion?
Yes, actually, I decided to become an archaeologist in sixth grade. And a lot of that stemmed from me going to the Southwest Museum, which is one of the museums here in Los Angeles County where I grew up and is within my traditional homelands of the Gaborone Tongva. And when we went to that museum, we were told that the Gaborone Tongva were extinct, which of course was a surprise to me and my relatives. And it was one of those awkward moments where I had a lot of my friends who knew that I was Gaborone Tongva would then look at me and say, you're extinct. So obviously you're not native. And then a lot of the representations of the native communities that were in the museum were stuck in the past. You had dioramas of half naked women, full naked men running around, you know, collecting in these dioramas. And again, the language in the past. And so I knew that I needed to do something in order to correct that misinformation that was going out there to the public. And in sixth grade, when I learned about archaeology and anthropology and found out that museum docents get their information from the documents that are created by archaeologists and anthropologists and ethnographers, that's what I needed to do in order to get a degree in those disciplines and rewrite the history from the perspective of my community.
It's awesome.
Yeah, that really is. And this may be a tough question to answer in a short amount of time, but you know, speaking to it, what do our listeners need to know about the history and heritage of the Tongva?
So the Gaborone Tongva are the original people of Los Angeles Basin, which includes the four Southern Channel Islands of Santa Catalina, San Clemente, San Nicolas, and Santa Barbara, as well as portions of Riverside, San Diego, and half of Orange County. And we have been in this area for over 10,000 years. And, you know, one of the issues about looking at how my community's history has been studied through the practice of archaeology is that a lot of the information that's out there states that the Gabbro Tongva didn't come into the area until about 4000 BP, meaning that we replaced and pushed out some other unknown named tribe prior to that time. But that's not the case. Based on our oral traditions, we actually emerged from Pavungna, which is a sacred site that's partially located on the campus of Cal State Long Beach, as well as a portion of it on the Veterans Administration Hospital campus. And people don't realize that this misinformation really impacts the way that the Gabbro Tongva can practice, or not practice, but continue to be recognized as a sovereign nation when thinking about trying to protect our ancestral sites, burial sites, et cetera, and trying to get those ancestors and their burial items reburied through various laws. When you have scientific studies stating that ancestors that are dated 9,000 years ago aren't yours and that some other community is related to them, really hurts. And so, you know, I myself, as well as other Tongva community leaders and other friendly local archaeologists, have really worked to create publications and put out there information that contradicts all of that archaeological interpretation that's incorrect.
And Laura, if I can hop in here, sure. I think it's fair to say that the lack of basic knowledge of tribes has hindered, and in some instances really hurt, the development of good working relationships with those tribes. So what can archaeologists, agencies, and individuals do to learn more about tribes and develop positive relationships with them and kind of stop these kinds of issues from happening?
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring that up. Just last week, myself, Dr. Dorothy Lippert, who works in the repatriation department at the Smithsonian Natural History Museum, and Dr. Michael Wilcox, who is a professor at Stanford, put together a poster for the Society for American Archaeology conference where we tackled just that. In our experience in working with archaeologists and tribal members, we found that a lot of good, positive relationships are hindered by the lack of basic information that archaeologists have. And so we created a poster, which we had hoped to present in person so that we could have like a Jeopardy-like type of interaction with people that would come visit us to see the poster and pose questions to them to see what their responses would be. And it really came up and thinking about one of the questions of how would you address a letter to a tribal leader? And one of our colleagues, when they sent a letter to, for instance, the chairman of one of the tribes, the title that he used or the introduction that he used was Dear, and then the last name of the chairman. And, you know, you wouldn't do that to the president of the United States.
No.
You wouldn't do that to any leader of any other type of nation. It's really disrespectful just to, you know, not to acknowledge the leadership position that person has within the community. And so right there, before you even talk to the person, just the letter and the written communication you're providing already has a disrespect. And unfortunately, because of the history of the ill treatment of Native communities through time by the United States government and other colonial settlers, there's already that wall that's there. And just that simple mislabeling and not using the correct title adds to that wall. And as an environmental protection professional, you want to work with that community member. You want to work in a collaborative relationship in order to make sure that you're identifying those important aspects of the area so that it does not get impacted by whatever project that you happen to be dealing with.
Right. For our listeners, and so we understand the context of what you're telling us, can you give us a little bit more description of the term sovereign nation and what it means?
So basically what sovereignty means, and it, when a Native American tribe has sovereignty, is that they have the power in order to dictate how who's a member of their nation, how they relate to those nations, and make decisions on their own without outside force. Unfortunately, although Native American communities practice sovereignty because we happen to be under living within the United States, Native American tribes are actually considered domestic dependent nations, which means that they practice sovereignty in a limited capacity. So for instance, Native American communities cannot go and make treaties with other nations outside of the United States, because that is a solely within the power of the United States. But again, it's the nation being able to decide how it wants to run itself, who its members are, and what it wants to do in order to make sure that its community continues on into the future.
Sure. Thank you for that additional description. Let's change subjects just a little bit. You're also the co-director of the Pimo Catalina Island Archaeological Project. Can you tell us a little bit about what's going on with that?
Yeah. So like I stated, you know, most of my life's work has been trying to eliminate the misinformation about the Gabrielino Otonga history and our community within the area. And one of the big things that we found, and actually within my own life, a lot of people in my family, as well as other Native American community members, hate archaeologists because archaeologists are considered to be grave diggers. And my family actually called me like, why would you want to be a grave digger? And for me, it wasn't about me going and digging graves. It was about protection. Going out and learning the language of archaeology, of the cultural resources management profession, in order to then use that knowledge to do as much protection as possible. And unfortunately, a lot of that is not taught to current archaeology students, and making sure that students understand the Native American perspectives to the items that may think are interesting. So for instance, even the term cultural resources, which can include artifacts and archaeological sites, but also for Native American community members, also contains natural resources. So berry picking patches or areas where we're collecting basketry plants. Or for me, I happen to be a flint napper going quarries where I go and get some good tool stone. That's also part of cultural resources. And it is really a larger explanation, is really a larger idea that is based within our indigenous perspective. So we created the Pimu Catalina Island Archaeology Project to teach students from an indigenous archaeology perspective. And indigenous archaeology is the practice of archaeology by, for, and with indigenous peoples. So making sure that any research that's being done, the indigenous community is right there at the table from the very beginning, that they're shaping the goals, they're participating in the research, and most importantly, they're there to help in the interpretation of the things that are being found. Very different from the way that traditional archaeology is being told. And with our field school that, unfortunately, we haven't run it recently, but we always brought Tongva community members as well as other Native community members so that they can listen and be enveloped in deep cultural history and song and perspectives of the Gabrielino Tongva community. One of the things that we used to do is have a Native foods workshop where the students would go and actually go into Catalina and harvest tule and coreopsis and cattails, elderberries, anything that was on the land. And then we would all get together and cook those foods, as well as other foods that were Native foods that were brought by our cooks, and I made them process it traditionally. So I made them go and make flakes. Yeah. So that they could cut the deer meat, and then made them grind acorns and leach acorns so that they can make the weewish or acorn mush. And so it gives them a different perspective of the artifacts and items that they're going to be seeing on the landscape, seeing that it's not just a single thing to be, you know, admired by, but that there's a deep connection between the ancestors that use them and our community today. And it's just a different way of thinking about it and understanding what your goal is and how what you are doing can affect the Native community.
And then the students are also working on a project where they came up with a unique dance move. Is that
Yeah. So, you know, as with all, you know, archaeological field schools, you always have to, you can't work all of the time. And so 1 year, I'm well known for being no nonsense. And, you know, we have a full week of readings and teachings and hands-on training. And so then when we go out into the world and survey, students would come and bring artifacts to me to review and say, is this an artifact? And then they're like, okay, what do you think? And you go through the characteristics and stuff like that. But toward the end of the project, they bring something to me. I look at it and I say, it's crap. And I immediately threw it over my shoulder. And so one night while they were in town at a bar dancing, they started to do this move where they're taking something in front of them and then they're throwing it behind them. It's crap. I didn't know anything about this. And then our end of the season party, one of the students did a whole dance of the whole field school. And one of it happens was the Desiree move of it's crap. And it was just, it's just hilarious, you know, but it's true. I mean, like, you know, what can I do? Because that's exactly the way that I did what I did when they brought me artifacts that weren't artifacts.
Oh, that's a great story. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. And honestly, like archaeology, like that ability for you to take a look at something and decide, okay, this is great or this is crap. And like that's such a hard thing for me to wrap my brain around. So how do you teach that? How do you get good at knowing what's great and what's not?
Well, and that's where, like, for instance, I also teach the students flintknapping. So if you understand the material you're working with, you understand the characteristics of how that material is used. And in the instance of stone breaks, you can see how a stone breaks naturally versus when it's man modified. Mm-hmm. And it's just one of those things where you see enough of it and you start to run through your brain. And this is what I tell the students. When you look at a flake, something that's made out of chert, when you hit a hammer stone onto your core, which is the raw material of the stone that you're using, there'll be telltale signs of what's called a bulbar percussion, for instance. Like you can understand the physics of the force that goes through that stone. There's waves of that force that scar the stone. And so a lot of times you won't get that in nature. But what's interesting is that sometimes when you're looking for flakes and you happen to be on a road, you'll get car facts, which are basically when the car runs over because of the weight of a car, it will actually, in some instances, fracture as if it looks like flakes. And so that's when you have to use the context. Like, okay, I have a flake that has all the characteristics, like it looks like it's man-made, but I now am on a road. And now I'm looking around to see, are there other flakes that match it? Does it look more recent? Than as opposed to something that's older. You know, you start to go through this checklist in your brain, and that's how I taught the students. Think about this, think about that. What characteristics make it an artifact? And that's how you make your decision. That's how you make your decision. And as you do it more, the better you get at it. But of course, there's always questionable artifacts where it could be and or couldn't be. And I happen to err on the side of caution just in case. Because there are some times you'll get things that were only used for a little bit. And so there's only a little bit of wear, but it looks like it could have been natural. But it does take a lot of hands-on in the field, looking at things over and over again in order to be good at it.
That's really cool. You know, I grew up in Florida, and I think everyone I know has found an arrowhead at one point or another. And I never have. So what's the coolest thing you've ever found?
Well, actually, the coolest thing that I've ever found, I did my graduate work at Harvard, and I was there while Dr. Elizabeth Chilton, who had come in as a professor for Northeastern Archaeology, ran a field school on Martha's Vineyard. And so while I was doing my dissertation research with members of the Wampanoag community, which are the original people of Martha's Vineyard, I kind of helped out at that field school. And so I was overseeing an excavation unit, and they were just starting to, and it's on a bluff above the beach. So it was a beautiful area, but it was covered in grass. And so you really couldn't see anything. And so as the students were trying to remove the top layer of that unit and remove the grass, they came upon a wooden pipe. And it was in perfect condition, kind of lying on top, had the shovel not kind of nicked it when they were putting it in the ground. But the bowl of the wooden pipe, if you cup your hand, it was a hand that was carved on the bottom of the bowl. And so it turned out that they radiocarboned that wooden pipe, and it turned out to be from the late 1600s. So thinking that that item had been just kind of there on the top, just waiting to be found, I think that was pretty cool.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible. Yeah. And we've talked a little bit about Section 106 of the, you know, National Historic Preservation Act, but we haven't really talked about NAGPRA yet. So could you maybe take a minute and talk to us about the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act and how it relates to the fieldwork that you do?
Yeah. So as I was stating previously, the reason why I wanted to be an archaeologist was to protect sites. But that also includes protecting our burial locations and sites. And for much of the history of the settlers within the United States, and actually all settlers that were on indigenous lands, were very interested in the people that they were contacting or coming into contact with during those first years. And sometimes that included going through and going to burial sites and excavating those ancestors and putting them in cabinets of curiosity so that they could show off to visitors when they would come to visit, or as scholarship started to expand in knowledge, particularly during the Enlightenment period, museums would pop up in order to capture these things and to be studied for the future. And for most Native communities, as well as the Gaborone Tongva, we believe that that hinders your ancestors' journey in the other worlds. And so they really shouldn't be dug up. And so in order to combat this issue, and in particular, because of a lot of the Indian wars that occurred in the 1800s, you actually had skeletons on museum shelves that were from named people, you know, various chiefs and leaders, and they had names. And so once Native community members started to realize this, they started to demand from these museums and institutions that they return the bodies of their ancestors and quite literally their relatives. And so a lot of Native American community members, as well as allies, started to work on creating legislation which would require museums, entities that receive federal funding to repatriate ancestors, as well as burial items and items of cultural patrimony and sacred items back to the tribes as soon as possible. And the act was passed in 1990 and is really looked at as human rights legislation. Like every individual has a right to be buried and stay buried. And so the Native American community was very ecstatic when this law was passed. However, 30 years later, we still have museums and other entities that have ancestors on the shelves. And Native communities are trying to work with those institutions to bring our ancestors and their items home. And some of these entities are dragging their feet and just refuse. And so one of the things that I do is try to help not only my community, but any other Native American community that may need help, to help them go through the process in order to make claims to those ancestors. For the Gaborone Tongva, not only are there Tongva ancestors in many of the museums in the United States, but also in museums outside of the United States.
Oh, wow.
In 2019, we had the ability to bring back ancestors home from the Bristol Museum. And that was something that we accomplished only because it was a conversation that we had with them for a number of different years. And NAGPRA doesn't apply to those collections that are outside the United States. And Great Britain does not have any type of law in which they have to repatriate ancestors back to Native American tribes. So it was with the continued discussion and dialogue with the Bristol Museum staff, as well as the city, that we could finally let them know and understand how hurtful it was for our community to have our ancestors so far away, and how much it would help our community to heal, to bring those ancestors back and rebury them.
Awesome. Well, that's a good win. It's nice to know that someone is out there working towards those things, and people listening can always contact you if they do need your help. Yes. We'll be putting that information into the description. We're running out of time. I got a couple last questions. We have learned on previous shows about climate change and how sea level rise is actually affecting the accessibility to sites that might have been once accessible to tribes. And you're helping to create a California Heritage Climate Vulnerability Assessment Tool with the California State Historic Preservation Office and the Scripps Institute of Oceanography, which is sounds really awesome. What are the goals of that project, and how does it work?
Well, one of the things is that this climate vulnerability tool was created by colleagues in Australia. And when we think about trying to figure out why things are important to us, it's always thought of in a Western sense. So thinking about an archaeological site, what is its scientific value? What could we learn from it? Mm-hmm. Is it a site that is unique because of that scientific knowledge that could be gained from it? And very rarely do you think about what the site means to Native American community members. In particular, in the state of California, as well as nationally, an archaeological site can be considered significant under federal and state law. And so there's a number of different criteria that the site has to meet in order to be considered significant. However, for Native American communities, it doesn't matter if the site or item is significant under the law or not. It has significance to us because it is an item in which connects us to our ancestors, to our history. And so even though, for instance, the National Register of Historic Places on the federal level and the California Register of Historical Resources on the state level here in California, those items that are considered significant and on those lists tend to be unique and important and kind of the best of the best. And for us, we don't care if it's the best of the best, or you may or may not get more archaeological data from it. It's a connection to our community. And you might think that it's just another milling stone that was used in order to process food. To us, we don't care if there's one, two, or 20 in the immediate area. Each one of those has meaning to us. And we want to make sure that we're protecting that so that we can then continue to use those items to talk about our history to our future generations.
Yeah. And it's a really important message. And like I say, I want to thank you for telling us that and teaching us a few things along the way. And, you know, we do also like to, you know, ask our guests about their secret hobbies and hidden talents. And you also make your own beaded jewelry?
If you were to see my house, you'd see all of the different beads. So, I have some. It's not even funny. Everywhere I go, I have to go to a bead store. And you know, it's what's the secret of making the jewelry. Yeah, I make jewelry, you know, using abalone and shells that I picked up from Catalina and mix it with other beads that, you know, glass beads and seed beads or whatever I can find.
Yeah.
But one of the guilty pleasures I have is organizing. So putting into the little boxes, into the bigger boxes, into the bigger boxes. And then, you know, then switching them over so that they're all, you know, organized and stuff like that. And that gives me joy in and of itself. You know, I make jewelry not only for myself, but to give as gifts to tribal leaders or visitors and, you know, of course, presents, you know, for birthdays and stuff like that. Yeah. But there's something in a world of chaos, there's something cool about being able to control something. And so controlling that kind of beating stuff makes me happy.
love it.
An archaeologist is going to find your home.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And be like, this is Desiree Martinez because look how organized everything is.
Well, I always think when I do flint knapping, you know, I'm making archaeological sites no matter where I'm at. So,
right. You
know, someday somebody's going to dig my backyard and they're like, oh my God, this is a Native American archaeological site. Well, technically, yes, but technically, no.
right. Oh my gosh. I love that.
Awesome. Well, we're running out of time. It's been great to have you on the show. And there's a lot of things that we could continue talking to you about. But before you go, is there anything else that you'd like to say or that we didn't get to ask you?
No, just basically, you know, one of the most important things for people that are not Native is to recognize that you're on Indigenous land if you're living, no matter where you're living. Yeah. And it really is and should be your responsibility to understand and acknowledge those tribal nations' presence on the land, know the history that occurred there, and try to be of service to the tribe if you can.
Yeah.
Awesome. Is there a place you would like people to go if they want to get in touch with you?
You can go to the Cogstone website, which is www.cogstone.com. And if you click on staff in the menu, you can click on my face and get in contact with me there.
Awesome. Thanks so much for joining us. It was great learning about you and the tribes, and we look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye. And that's our show. I want to thank Desiree Martinez so much for being here. She gave us a lot of really great and interesting information. So I hope you guys enjoyed it. Please be sure to check us out next Friday and every Friday. We love doing this show, so we'd love to have you on. I don't know why I'm saying all these extra words. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. Catch you next time. Bye.